Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What's behind the rise in suicides? Joining us now is Mark Kaplan. He's professor of social welfare at the UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs. His publications include The Social Nature of Male Suicide, A New Analytic Model, Suicide Among Male Veterans, A Prospective Population-Based Study, and Physical Illness, Functional Limitations, and Suicide Risk. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. Thank you so much for being with us, Mark Kaplan. It's great to have you with us. We wanted to do this segment partly because there has been some evidence, some reports that the suicide rates are going up in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to start to understand what are the factors that explain the rise in suicide rates and what this really means for a society. So why don't we start with what explains the rise, for example, in the CDC report that says these deaths have risen since 2005, something like more than half don't know they have mental health disorders.
The data they reported were not entirely new. I mean, we knew the rates were on the rise. What surprised a lot of people were the additional information that was also reported at the time. Not only did they report trends based on a particular database that they have, but they also reported new findings, or relatively new findings, from something called the National Violent Death Reporting System, which was quite interesting and which got far less attention than the rate on the rise since 1999. Namely, the National Violent Death Reporting System, which I have been funded to study that data set, showed that, which is quite interesting, that is that there are a number of suicide decedents who do not follow the standard, who do not have the standard psychiatric profile associated with suicidality, that perhaps psychopathology is not present. So there were some additional findings that one needs to look at in order to fully understand, the changing nature of suicide in this country. It is indeed going up, but it's not going up in all groups at the same rate. One needs to disaggregate, so to speak, and look at certain groups that seem to be more vulnerable. That is, people in their middle years, men in their middle years in particular, men in their, 45 to 64, which has been getting quite a bit of attention based on work that the two economists, Case and Deaton, showed a couple of years ago. The rise in, that's the group that's experienced the most dramatic rise in suicide in the United States.
So traditionally, has suicide been more prevalent in one gender than the other, or?
Yes.
So
yes.
Historically, how has it been versus?
Well, there are very few, globally speaking, there are very few countries. In fact, we all know of one country, that is China, where the rate of suicide is higher among women than men. Outside of China, most countries pretty much follow the same patterns. Let's focus on the United States for a moment. And these are the most recent statistics from the CDC, namely 2016. And there were about 45,000 deaths overall in the country. Out of those 45,000, about 35,000 were males, and about just a little bit over 10,000 were females. The rate, the ratio of men to women is about 3 to 4 to 1, depending on which age, too. That's for every age group. But in older people, that is older than 65, men are 12 times, have a rate of suicide that is 12 times higher than their female counterparts. So there's this variability across the board. Some have said that there's a gender paradox in the sense that women are more likely to attempt, and that is true based on the data, and men are more likely to complete and die by suicide, partly due to the methods that men use. More men who die by suicide attempt suicide with a die of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Women are more likely to use less lethal means, that is, means with a lower case fatality rate. But that's also changing. I have one of my PhD students is looking at changing patterns or trends in gun suicide among women, and those rates are on the rise, and about a third of all deaths, suicide deaths among women involve guns.
So let's talk about why some of these trends are shifting a little bit. Mm-hmm. I understand there are some economic factors, there are some social factors, as well as psychological ones. Can you divide these up and help us understand what each of these seems to be?
what perhaps you might best refer to as the psychosocial influences on the suicide rate. And for one, there are demographic factors. There are geographic factors. There are cultural factors. Case in point, I recently was having this conversation about Korea. Korea today, unlike the past, has the highest, one of the highest suicide rates, according to the OECD. Some have tried to look at that problem as purely psychological, but I think that misses the point. There are major cultural changes, religious changes, from religions of the past to the religions of the present, towards a more Christian, towards Christianity. So there are a lot of changes occurring at the national level in Korea that might be contributing to the shifts in the suicide rate. In the United States, I was funded by the National Institute of Health, NIH, to study specifically the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, to study the effects of the Great Recession of 10 years ago. And I think there's some interesting findings there that are relevant in terms of the social determinants of suicide. Namely, at the time of the recession, that is end of 2007, December officially starting December 2007, and lasting or ending in June of 2009, we studied using a natural experiment design. In other words, we looked at data before the recession, during the recession, and after the recession. And what we found was the following. Men, the rate of suicide did go up. The rate of alcohol associated, that is, men who died by suicide had alcohol on board, had consumed alcohol, and in many cases were intoxicated. That also went up, which might be a marker of impulsivity. And also what's interesting, and perhaps the most surprising finding for us, and we published these a couple years ago, was the fact that there was a lag effect, a delayed effect for women. So women who were subjected to the Great Recession had a rise in their suicide rate and a rise in their alcohol-linked suicide rate a few years after the men. So there was a delayed effect in the delayed adverse effects of the Great Recession on women.
So what does this tell us in terms of economics? I mean, I'm assuming that while we've got this trend shifting when we have a Great Recession, so there's economic pressure on people, obviously not everybody commits suicide. And so there must be a combination of more than one factor, right? So mm-hmm. we've got the Absolutely. Economic factors coming in, and some people are more susceptible than others.
Absolutely.
What is that?
Yes. That's always an important question. Why, you know, we often focus on those who die and focus on, if you will, the negatives. But what about the positives? What about those who were resilient, who were capable, had the capacity to weather, you know, it could be host resistance, what epidemiologists called host resistance, could be a combination of biological factors, genetic constitution, psychological constitution, social supports. They had protections. They had folks to lean on. But there are many individuals who did not weather the adversities of the economic recession. That is, people and when you look, when you dig a little bit deeper and you drill down a little bit, what you see during the Great Recession was that those who were had fewer years of education had a much higher rate. Those in a lower socioeconomic position to start with were more likely to have a much higher unemployment rate. You know, the unemployment rate varied according to one's education level. Education, to some extent, is destiny as a socioeconomic factor. But in terms of the Great Recession, those with a graduate degree, at least 4 years of college plus maybe a few years of graduate school, had a unemployment rate that was 4%, if not under that. Those with just a high school or less had nearly 12%, even higher rates in some cases. And there was some geographic variability, too. So to add to this mix of psychological vulnerability, gender, genetic, also geographic, there are really critical differences, at least in the United States, according to where you live. If you live on the West Coast, the suicide rates are lower. On the East Coast, northeast part of the country, they're lower. In the middle, they're higher. Between the Mississippi and the mountain region, and that's the area with the highest suicide rate. And then on top of all this, and I did allude to this early on, the role of guns in all this, because in the case of men, over 60% of men who die by suicide do so with a gun. With women, it's about a third.
So it does raise a lot of questions. And one of those questions related to guns is whether that rate of dying by guns, if suicide should be considered on par with homicide. As an expert on suicide, what would you say on this?
That's an important question, because the debate surrounding, and I'm interested in firearm violence as well. I teach a course at UCLA on firearm violence, and I'm very interested in firearm violence, not only as it pertains to suicide, but in general. Two-thirds of all, I'll give you the figures, about 34% of gun deaths in this country are homicides, about 62% are suicides. So the lion's share of gun deaths in this country are suicides, but the debate about gun control has been confined in many ways to homicides and maybe accidental deaths. There's been far less attention. It's almost as if it's a hidden epidemic, if you will, of gun suicides. I don't quite understand why. I think it has some cultural explanations. I think there's certain, you know, it might have something to do with the stigma of mental illness, as well as, you know, people who might have a mental health issue who are perhaps suicidal and have access to guns. That's a debate that we haven't had in this country. So I am always concerned that the discussion, both at in the press and the media, as well as at the policymaking level, have focused away from suicides involving guns. And let me just give you an example. According to the data on which states have the most restrictive gun laws, when you look at California, California gets an A+ from the Brady Giffords organizations on in terms of restrictiveness, gun restrictiveness. Compared to the rest of the country, California, when you look at the rest of the country and you look at certain age groups, you know, nearly 50-60% of the suicides involve guns. In California, it's 30% or under. So restrictive gun laws do matter in terms of reducing the likelihood of gun use among suicidal individuals.
And then the other factor that you have pointed to in your work is about poverty and the role of poverty.
Exactly.
So
right.
Let's talk about poverty and why it's a role and that trajectory. It doesn't, of course, explain when wealthy people commit suicide, but it sounds like what you're saying is that more poor people commit suicide than wealthy people.
Here's an interesting point about that, is that there's just so much that we don't know about suicide, and we're lumping a lot of heterogeneous factors. Suicides, the types of, you know, I've for one, have always said that, you know, when we look at suicide mortality or suicide morbidity, that we need to separate genders. I mean, the phenomenon of suicide among women is quite different from the phenomenon of suicide among men. Men are more likely to die. Women are more likely to survive after an attempt. And the question of the socioeconomic determinants, I think that's a different type of suicide than the type of suicide that we often think of. You know, the recent deaths of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain kind of highlighted, you know, the white, you know, that perhaps well-educated white individuals are most vulnerable. Well, that is true to some extent, but there are a lot of hidden suicides. There's suicidal behavior that doesn't necessarily lead to death, but is clearly a form of self-harm that's associated with one's socioeconomic position, one's disadvantage. Poverty emerged as a factor in one of the last studies we did under this grant was to try to disentangle the different determinants during the Great Recession. We looked at unemployment. We looked at home foreclosures, which was one of the markers, right, of the Great Recession. You know, we take a look at any pictures, you'll see signs everywhere around the country for foreclosed homes. And then we also looked at the rate of poverty. And what really stood out, which was a surprising finding, what above everything else, it was poverty that seemed to be driving up the suicide rate and the alcohol-linked suicide rate.
Are there certain common factors that we can point to psychologically that merge with these social factors, like certain emotions? And I ask this partly because of things like anxiety and shame. And I guess it was a week ago, we did a program on healing trauma in people mm-hmm. who have experienced trauma. And we talked about emotions like shame mm-hmm. and how hard it is to heal somebody who has persistent shame. Are these emotions something that are important common ground that go with the social factors?
They do, but they should not be stripped away from their social context. And that is depression. There are social determinants of depression. When one loses a job, one becomes demoralized. One becomes, begins to feel those negative emotions that may contribute to a trajectory leading up to a suicide attempt. So what concerns me is that we tend to individualize, if you will, or over-psychologize the phenomenon of suicide. Many people have said, folks in the profession of, studying suicide, have said that, suicide should not be, is not the exclusive domain of the psychological sciences, that we need to look at, if there's one thing we learned from Durkheim, writing in the late 1800s, who is still relevant today, major shifts, societal shifts, the way society is organized, all contribute to a rise in suicide. And that to do anything less than examine those social forces, I think we do ourselves an injustice by failing to look at the broader, the more distal determinants of suicidal behavior.
So one of the factors, so I'm a political scientist, and so I'm always curious about the politics of all of this. Mm-hmm. And one of the politics I would imagine is the politics of healthcare.
Yeah.
And where that might come into play. So, for example, we do get messages societally about how we should be able to heal ourselves, right? We've got plenty of self-help books and gurus and life coaches.
Right.
And
but it's often heal thyself.
Yes, it's often heal thyself. And it happens to be expensive.
Of course, but the issue of personal responsibility is creeping back. As you know, we are attaching all sorts of conditions to receiving welfare, so to speak, whether it is health care, whether it is food stamps, whether it is you name it. We are putting the onus, that's the result of a conservative wave. That is the imposition of responsibility on the individual, as opposed to assuming a more socially just approach, which is an emphasis on collective responsibility. We're not quite there yet. Let me give you an example of during the time we were studying the Great Recession, I had some interactions with colleagues in Sweden. I spent my last Fulbright in Sweden, and I established some close relationships, and I went back to them after we started our project, and I said, did you guys experience the rise in suicide that we did? And there was a pause there, and he said, "No, not at all. We didn't. Nothing really changed that much. The reason for that is that they stepped in, and that safety net was strengthened. In other words, workmen's compensation, unemployment compensation, everything that we've wrapped around people at times." All those services were there, and the state stepped in, and there was a collective response to it, and they softened the blow of the global financial crisis in Sweden. We basically lowered the safety net and allowed people to fall. Many of them fell and wound up taking their own lives.
So I imagine a big part of this is also that sort of social stigma that you sort of alluded to in this whole conversation, mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. sort of falling down and not having the ability to pick oneself up,
exactly.
and also the stigma that gets attached.
Exactly. Well, you're talking about multiple barriers here. One is the stigma. I mean, there's no doubt, we've tried for years to establish parity between mental health and physical health. We're nowhere close to that. I mean, no one will tell you with a straight face that we have achieved parity in terms of treating the two where there's no stigma. As you know, there are many people who walk around who have kept silent about their distress. And there are a lot of people distressed. It's not just depression. There are probably more people who are distressed out there but are unable, unwilling to discuss their feelings.
Now, do you think that there are a chunk of people in this percentage that have no known mental illness that are actually suffering from a mental illness?
The bottom line is that we don't know. Let me take you back to something early on. We don't even know how many people die by suicide every year, believe it or not. The 45,000 people approximately who died in 2016 is probably an underestimate. I have colleagues of mine in West Virginia, Professor Ian Rocket and Professor Eric Kane at Rochester, who published a piece in one of the JAMA journals a few years ago. And they noted that unlike the official statistic of suicide being the 10th leading cause of death, they argue that if we really took into account, you know, many of these deaths that are due to drug intoxication that look very much like suicides, our rate of suicide would probably be rank 8th, not 10th. So, and years ago, the Institute of Medicine, in their 2002 report, Reducing Suicide, a National Imperative, argued that our rates are probably, the true rate is probably 25% higher. And let me tell you something else which we have uncovered, and this is somewhat exploratory analysis, but it is very informative, and that is there are lots of silent suicides. You know, people who do not have the standard markers of standard psychiatric markers of suicidal behavior, that is, don't have a history of depression, don't have a problem with substance abuse, all those things that we often attribute, all those risk factors that we often aim our efforts at. In the analysis we did, there were about 22%, in the database we had, about 22% of the men were basically men without any of these markers, these standard factors that we often say are contributors to suicide.
Now, there's something else that people have questioned, and that is this role of sort of copycat whenever it's in the media. Is that a real phenomenon, or is that just people being afraid?
Well, I was interviewed after one of the recent deaths by a celebrity. After each one of them, but one of them, you know, because this came up shortly after that, I think it was Robin Williams, right? There was a lot of concern. There was some research that was published, a study that came out that said there were some deaths attributed to him. There's pretty strong evidence based on the World Health Organization that there is some evidence that a death of a celebrity can trigger some other suicides. There's no doubt about it. But the question is, were these individuals already vulnerable? Did somebody go from no vulnerability at all, zero vulnerability, to becoming vulnerable enough to take their own lives? There are questions that we simply don't know. There's an inability, I think, in the field to truly embrace complexity. And suicide, to me, is one of the most complex public health problems that I ever looked at, and I'm a public health researcher.
Yeah, you must think that in order for somebody to commit suicide, they must be in so much pain that staying alive is not an option.
Oh, absolutely. One of my areas of interest is quality of life, health-related quality of life. And there are people, there are individuals who feel that their condition, they feel worse than dead. That's what they say. So yes, there are people who we might even come across who feel a profound sense are facing some existential crisis and feel a tremendous amount of distress in their lives and don't communicate this. And it's true. It's probably true for men. You know, they're men who don't often like to talk about their emotions. You know, that's probably playing, you know, male psychology is playing some role in why, you know, in explaining why men have a higher rate of death due to suicide.
So I suppose there's a certain amount of compassion that we should probably be lending to this situation as a society, mm-hmm. that perhaps we're not giving enough to.
Well, you know, I think if we were a more compassionate society, we would probably devote more of our national resources to the study of suicide. Just case in point, I just happened to look this up the other day, and I was looking at what the National Institutes of Health spend on the and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention spend on the on research involving, you know, studying the epidemiology and the prevention of suicide. You know, we spend this is a couple years back now, about 5 years, 2013. Suicide received $37 million, okay? Heart disease, $1.2 billion. HIV/AIDS, $2.9 billion. Prostate cancer, $266 million. And guess what? HIV/AIDS, the death rate between 2002 and 2013 dropped by 53%. Heart disease, the death rate dropped by 29%. The prostate cancer, the rate dropped by about 14%. Suicide, the rate went up 2003 to 2013 by over 20%.
So do you think that the paucity of funding to understand suicide is coming from our own sort of societal denial?
Well, I think it's a denial. I think there's the historic problem, and this is an ancient problem, of some of the myths, the stereotypes, the stigma of mental illness. I mean, that there's no question about that. But not everybody who takes their life had a diagnosable psychiatric problem. You know, there's a dispute about that. There's a dispute about where that data comes from. If you look at other countries, the role of psychopathology in suicide is a lot less significant of a factor than in the United States. But there's no question, you know, mental health is a big problem. Guns is a big problem, too. You know, the problem of, at least in suicide, most suicides are gun-related. And they're even more gun-related among men. And if we were more serious about the gun debate, we would probably do something about, limiting access to guns among people who are, perhaps suicidal. But not even, you know, there. As I said before, there are people who are not suicidal who have access to gun and wind up taking their own lives. They may have faced, and this is one of the things we found in an earlier study, that sometimes all it takes is a major crisis, some existential crisis that drives people to short-circuit some of the standard trajectories that people take to when they take their lives and basically go from experiencing a major crisis to ending their lives with a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
So it's probably... The country is probably in a bit of an existential crisis at the moment.
States. I mean, it's almost a state of denial in many ways of the role that guns play in suicide, the magnitude of the problem of suicide, and it's probably even worse than people think. In many age groups, it's the number two or number three leading cause of death. In this country, it's probably the eighth leading cause of death, and yet we devote so few of our national resources, and I think that's a shame, and that's the denial, and that's the lack of collective responsibility for this important, you know, public health crisis.
And so, in terms of where we go from here, if you were going to make one very solid recommendation, would you just say we need to understand this better, so we need to devote more funds to it, or would there be something else?
One, obviously, approach is to extend funding. For instance, there's a national database called the National Violent Death Reporting System. And the National Violent Death Reporting System, or NVDRS, has been historically underfunded, and it would provide us with some insights. It's a unique database in the industrialized world, and it would provide us with new information on some of the factors associated with suicide deaths. I think we need to spend more money at the national level in terms of prevention at the NIH and CDC and other agencies. That would be helpful. But we also, at a more theoretical conceptual level, I think we need to step back a little bit and widen our lens, or what I would call widening our lens. You know, many of us operate in silos as we study suicide. Most of us do not adopt a truly transdisciplinary approach to suicide. And given the complexity and the more proximal versus distal risk factors involved, I think there's a real need to reconceptualize how we've approached, how we've studied suicide. We need new streams of funding, and we need to have a political will at the national level and at the highest level. I mean, most of our leaders have tried and have been unsuccessful. President Obama tried to expand the NVDRS, tried to do more through the CDC, and, you know, it unfortunately, some of these issues get bogged down because of the gun debate, you know, get caught up in gun politics. And that's a big problem. But, you know, we have had on the books for a long, long time something called the Dickey Amendment, which has basically placed a moratorium on the funding of gun research in this country, as you might know, through the CDC and the NIH. This goes back to the 90s. So we are far behind in understanding the role that guns play in suicide.
Well, Mark Kaplan, I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Mark Kaplan, he's professor of social welfare at the UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs. His publications include The Social Nature of Male Suicide, A New Analytic Model, Suicide Among Male Veterans, A Prospective Population-Based Study, and Physical Illness, Functional Limitations, and Suicide Risk.